Hi, I'm Dan Q, and you're listening to a podcast that nobody asked for, exclusively about things that only I find interesting. Today, we'll be talking about my experience of nostalgia, music, and computers. As usual, there's a blog post to accompany this episode. You'll find it today at danq.link/nostalgia. Nostalgia, music, and computers. In this episode, I'll be thinking about things that make me nostalgic for other things that objectively aren't very similar to them by revisiting my experience of being 9, 11, 13, and 15 years old. When I hear Dawnbreaker, I feel like I'm 9 years old. And I've been allowed to play Outrun on the arcade cabinet at Westview Leisure Centre, where I have swimming lessons. My swimming lesson's finished, and normally I should go home, but on those rare occasions I could get away with a quick pause in the lobby for a game, I'd usually gravitate towards the Wonder Boy machine. I'd much later build an arcade cabinet of my own and finally win Wonder Boy. It only took me 30-something years. I say rare occasions I could get away with a pause for a video game because my dad in particular considered arcade games financially wasteful. We have a perfectly good computer at home, he'd point out. And we did. We had a microcomputer at home that could load a text-based adventure from an audio cassette and be ready to play in only 3 to 5 minutes. So it wasn't entirely the same thing. Outrun was an impressive game, spectacularly fast, I mean like eye-wateringly fast for video games at the time, which was part of what gave it such appeal. Have you ever played Sonic Racing Crossworlds? My 9-year-old is obsessed with it. The first time I ever played Crossworlds, I was slightly overwhelmed by the speed and the colours. It's this high-octane visual feast. Well, that today is what Outrun felt like to those of us who in the 1980s were used to much simpler and slower arcade games. There's something about Outrun's steering wheel and pedals that give it a physicality that the joystick and two buttons controls of Wonder Boy and Mario Brothers couldn't quite replicate. In any case, what I said was that when I hear Dawnbreaker, I feel like I'm 9 years old. Dawnbreaker, of course, wouldn't come out until 2018. Let's just listen for a moment to Dawnbreaker. So it's this cheery, happy major chord progression. The whole track's like this. It just feels like the whole time you're supposed to be in a crescendo. It's always building up and up. It's a great song. It's fantastic driving music. And when I realised I had this nostalgic attachment to hearing Dawnbreaker and it reminding me of being 9 years old and playing Outrun in an arcade cabinet, at first I thought, well, it must sound similar. Let me remind myself what the music was in Outrun. Now, the most recognisable and iconic track in Outrun is a piece of music called Magical Sound Shower, which sounds like this. So, it doesn't actually sound a lot like Dawnbreaker, but you've got to admit, it's got the same energy. It has got some thematic things similar, and I'm sure that if you're more experienced with music theory, you can point out exactly why, but the thing that they both have in common is they both feel like video game driving music. Now, it turns out there's a reason for that. I didn't know when I first heard it, but Dawnbreaker was also written to be video game driving music. It was written for a game called Forza Horizon 4, which I have never played. But somehow it touches that same thing in my head that says this is electronic music for driving to. And when it comes on, if I'm in the car or even if I'm cycling and there's an open road ahead of me, it gives me that same feeling of tearing along in Outrun. By the way, I heard there's talk of a movie adaptation of Outrun, which could turn out to be the absolute worst video game to movie concept that I will definitely watch. When I start a new Ruby project, I feel like I'm 11 years old and I'm writing Locomotive Basic on my family's Amstrad CPC. Like many self-taught coders in the 1980s, my journey as a programmer began with Basic. After that, I transitioned to more grown-up languages, if you like. That's certainly how I saw them. C, Assembly, Pascal, HTML, Perl, Visual Basic. Does that count as a grown-up language? Java, Delphi, JavaScript, PHP, SQL, ASP, classic, not .NET. CSS, Lisp, C#, Ruby, Python, which I didn't get on with so well. Go, Elixir, and many more, I'm sure. But as I transitioned to some of these languages, I missed the feeling of programming in Basic, where every line brought me joy. And at first, as a young teen, I assumed that the tedious bits and the administrative overhead of programming, linking, compiling, syntactical surprises, arcane naming conventions and the like, was just what real grown-up programming was supposed to feel like. But Ruby helped remind me that programming can be fun for its own sake. Not just because of the fun problems you're solving or the fun product you're creating, but because of the love of programming. To this day, the experience of starting a new Ruby project feels to me like booting up my Amstrad CPC and being able to just joyfully type in code that will just work. I still learn new programming languages because I love learning new programming languages, but I'm yet to find one that makes me want to write poetry in it in the way that Ruby does. And I say that because I have literally written poetry in Ruby before. Back in 2011, I wrote a haiku which goes as follows. Death grind, age equals 0. Die if age equals 78. Grind age plus 1, end. When written out properly, it's got a depth and meaning that you can't really get in the spoken version. It uses recursion, for example, which sort of reinforces the idea that every year of your life gives you a bigger burden to carry and a larger amount of memory consumed, and that doesn't really translate, so I probably shouldn't be telling you it in a podcast. Go follow the link at danq.link/nostalgia and read it there instead. When I hear 808 states in your face, I feel like I'm 13 years old and I'm painting advanced Hero Quest miniatures, or possibly Warhammer Quest miniatures. It's a bit of a blur. In the attic at my dad's house. I love that it sort of uses the bassline as a substitute for the drums. Man, that does sound like electronic music in the 1990s, doesn't it? Every single bit of it. When I was 13 years old, I'd cobbled together a stereo system of my very own, mostly from other people's cast-offs, and I'd set it up in the den, which was our recently converted attic. Eventually, my dad and I had given up on our dream of using our partially boarded loft to intermittently build a model railway layout using second-hand and trade-in parts from a shop called Trains and Transport. Trains and Transport was exactly the kind of nerdy shop you're imagining right now. Underlit, occupied by a parade of shuffling neckbeards, between whom young me would squeeze to see if the mix and match bin had any good condition HO gauge flexi track. In any case, by the time I was a teenager, we converted the attic, and it became the den, a secondary space, principally for my use, which was, for the most part, a concession for me vacating my large bedroom and switching to the smallest imaginable bedroom in the house, barely big enough for a single bed, which in turn enabled my then-new baby sister to have a bedroom of her own. In any case, I would sit up in the den and I'd paint miniatures and I'd turn on my built-out-of-cast-offs stereo and I'd take a mixtape My friends and I made mixtapes and trade them with one another all the time. One particular mixtape began with a copy of 808 States In Your Face, and that was often the one I would put in when I'd sit down to paint. My copy of In Your Face was possibly recorded from the radio by my friend Scarry, who always had a tape deck set up and his finger primed close to the record key whenever the charts came on. Advanced Hero Quest was quite cool, really. It had all these fabulously ornate secondary components like doors that were actually hinged, so when you'd lay out a dungeon you could see the state of doors and whether you'd left them open or closed, which mattered if you were going to be firing a crossbow through at an advancing skaven. I painted all of the miniatures, including all of the secondary ones like doors and chests, and my copy of Advanced Hero Quest looked pretty badass, I thought. In any case, I'd put my music on, and the thing you've got to remember is that in a world before CD audio took off, shuffle wasn't a thing. Even on any album or any mixtape or anything similar, you'd usually listen to all of the tracks in sequence. I soon learned to recognise my copy of tracks by their particular cut-in and cut-out points, static and noise, some of which, amazingly, survived into the MP3 era when I would rip my tapes to digital formats, and some of them retained their pops and clicks. I'd also retain a memory of which tracks came before or after things on a tape, and there are still, to this day, pieces of music where, when I hear them, I expect them to be followed by something that used to come after them on some mixtape that I used to listen to 30-something years ago. That we listened to music in sequence was doubly true for tapes, where rewinding and fast-forwarding took time and seeking to a particular track was challenging compared to, say, vinyl. Any given song would loop around a lot if I couldn't be bothered to change tapes instead of just flipping again and again. But somehow, whenever I hear In Your Face, I'm transported right back in time to a reverie so corporeal that I can almost smell the paint thinner. Speaking of which, flipping tapes, do you remember that? How amazing a user interface affordance was it that playing one side of an audio cassette was mechanically equivalent to slowly rewinding the other side. Contrast, say, other tape formats like VHS, which were one-sided, and so while rewinding, there was literally nothing else that your player could be doing. A full audio cassette was a marvellous thing, and I especially loved the serendipity when a recognisable gap on one side of the tape might approximately line up with one on the other side, which meant that you could, say, flip the tape right after the opening intro to one song and know that you'd be pretty much at the start of a different song on the other side. Is there any other medium that has anything analogous to that? I say, whenever I hear In Your Face, I'm transported back to that point in time, but that's pretty rare, unless I choose to put it on. Though, amazingly, last summer I did hear it organically. It was coming out of a Bluetooth speaker in a narrowboat moored in the Oxford Canal near Cropredy, where I was using the towpath to return from a long walk to a Northamptonshire geocache. That was a particularly surprising place to overhear such a song, given that many of the boats moored there were for attendees of Fairport's Cropredy Convention, at which, being a folk music festival, I wouldn't have expected to see a significant overlap of Madchester-era acid house music. But there you go. When I see a personal web page, I feel like I'm 15 years old. And the web is on the cusp of becoming the hot killer application for the internet. At this point, I'd been lucky enough to be online for a few years by now. My first online experience was with BBS Systems. Gosh, the very first time will have been on a mid-80s PC 1512 with a 2800 board acoustic coupler. But I got onto the internet at a point in the early 90s at which the web existed, but it hadn't yet demonstrated it would eventually come to usurp the services that existed before it. So I got to use Usenet, Gopher, Telnet and IRC before I saw my first web browser, which was Cello, I think. I eventually switched to Netscape Navigator. At this time in history, when I was 15, basic ISP-provided hosting would soon start to compete with cheap, free and ad-supported services like GeoCities to be the place to keep your homepage. But since its early days, the web has always been this expressive medium. When you open a web browser, what you're seeing is the blank canvas of potential. And with modern browser debug tools, you don't even have to reach for your text editor to create in that medium. I don't often see a browser with no tabs open. On the rare occasion I ever close my browser these days, it reopens with whatever 100 or so tabs I was using back as I left them. Oh gosh, I'm a slob with tabs. When you open a browser with no tabs open, it's a window that sort of says to you, the entire potential of the web, and by proxy the world, exists within this newly opened window. Back then, the limitations of the medium in this pre-CSS era were a cause of inspiration, not of confinement. Web pages of the mid-1990s used all kinds of imaginative tricks with font sizes and tables and background colours in order to lay out and style their content. But nowadays, even with the hugely expanded toolbox that developers have, virtually every corporate homepage fundamentally looks the same. There's a logo in the top left, search and login in the top right, if applicable, a cookie and privacy notice which covers virtually everything until you work out the right incantation to make it go away without surrendering your firstborn child. Then there's a hero banner, some below-the-fold content that everyone skips over, and a fat footer with several columns of links that ensure all the keywords are there so that people never have to see this page, and instead the search engine will drop them off at the relevant child page and not one of their competitors. And then finally, maybe, at the bottom, there's a line of icons which represents various centralised social networks, and at least one of them's out of date because it's been renamed or changed its branding, or because nobody with any moral fortitude uses that network anymore. And wait, that's the same one three times. You know the one I'm talking about. But before the corporate web became the default, personal homepages brought a level of personality that for a while I was worrying was forever dead. But I've recently been really inspired to see how much personal homepages didn't die. Everybody's free to write websites, so they're still out there and they're still amazing. I mean, they're harder to find. SEO manipulating behemoths dominate the search results, while social networks push their apps and walled gardens to try to keep us off the bigger, wider web. But the more you cut both of those out of your online life, the calmer and happier you'll be. If you visit the blog post version of this podcast episode at danq.link/nostalgia, you'll see screenshots of a dozen or so personal homepages I visited while writing this script, and every single one of them makes me want to give the web an enormous hug. Last year, I wrote, "Writing HTML is punk rock. A platform is a tool of the establishment," and that still feels right to me. It turns out that I get nostalgic about technology in the same way as I get nostalgic about music. I don't know what that says about me. Do I keep them in the same part of my brain, or is it the nostalgia that connects the two of them? What will I look back on from today when I listen to whatever music I'm listening to in another 30 years? 30. Oh, I'm old. Once again, this episode was based on a blog post, which has got lots more information, which today you can find at danq.link/nostalgia. If you've enjoyed today's episode, go there and leave me a comment, or drop me an email on podcast@danq.me. And as always, Dan Q for listening. Dan Q very much.